Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's move to our first email of the evening. This is from Brad in SoCal. Dear Dr. Dawn, two extended family members, father and daughter, have recently been diagnosed with hemorrhoids. The ages are around 60 and around 20. The daughter also suffers from constipation. They have started taking fiber supplements and adding more fiber to their diet. However, from observation, the daughter does not appear to select a diet with much fiber. She also complains that the fiber supplement capsules don't seem to help much and seem to make the constipation worse. She also has been taking Miralax daily. Any suggestions on how to gauge what an adequate intake of fiber is and other steps that might help with both hemorrhoids and constipation? Well, Brad, it's not a question I get often, but actually it's a very important one. The first thing I want to say about this is that father-daughter, right? DNA loads the gun and environment and behavior pull the trigger. So if we live long enough, our DNA will tend to catch up with us, father. But as in the case of the daughter, she probably is vulnerable from a genetic standpoint, but then really not working that environment pulls the trigger thing as well as she needs to be. Before we go any further, I do want to emphasize, when we start talking about hemorrhoids, I have to tell you and tell the entire audience, the anus evolved for one purpose. And while I have no comments about its use for other purposes, it was not built for other purposes. It was evolved for basically to create a storage location for waste products and then a manner for controlled release of those waste products in an appropriate environment for the release of such waste products. So let's talk about exactly what hemorrhoids are. And these are a weak area. Let's talk first of all about, you know, the anus. You have at the end of the intestinal tract, you have a muscular sphincter, and that sphincter has a very large blood supply, and above that muscle there are large blood vessels which can become blocked essentially and unable to drain. And when that happens, you get effectively varicose veins of the inside of the anus. These are called hemorrhoids, and they're those just like those balls that you see on a bad case of varicose veins. They're blood vessels where they've blown out the girdle, so to speak, of muscle, and the endothelium and is pooching out between the bits of muscle. Think of something coming between interdigitated fingers and you'll have the idea. The area here does not have much in the way of nerves, and so as a result, people with internal hemorrhoids usually only find out about them because they have bleeding. External hemorrhoids are another matter. They're on the outside side of that sphincter, and again, lots of blood vessels possible for them to herniate, and you get essentially a varicose anus. They often will clot, and then the clot will basically drain over time. It'll dissolve more accurately, and you'll be left with a little swinging tag of tissue. I see those all the time. It's part of my occupation to check that area for signs of cancer. The key to not getting hemorrhoids, besides picking the right DNA, and we'll come back to that in a minute, is to control the environment. So genetics influence the strength of those blood vessels. And remember, they're basically varicose veins. So if they're more prone to stretching and bulging, then you're going to run into a problem. That inherited predisposition is essentially an inherited weakness in the tissues. And so hemorrhoids do indeed run in families. But it's just a risk. It's not a destiny. And there are myriad factors, diet, constipation, pregnancy, that increase pressure. Prolonged sitting, especially if you are driving a truck, one of those big trucks, because you're basically taking your legs and using that to handle the clutch and the gas. So you're really supporting yourself completely on your butt. And there's a tendency to gain weight when you live that lifestyle. And you're stretching the tissues at the same time. So, you know, stretch and pressure really does push the tissues, which is why behavior becomes so important. Now, there was a study, well, before we leave genetics, there was a big study done looking at genetic influences on this. And it was a big study, like they had over a million or almost a million individuals. They used the Europe Biobanks and the United States and the UK and 23andMe. And so they had a lot of DNA that they could look at. And they looked at diagnoses, and they found 102 regions in the human genome that increased the risk of hemorrhoidal disease. And as they looked, they found that the genes were primarily genes expressed in blood vessels and smooth muscle, which is smooth muscle, the GI tract. So, for example, the internal anal sphincter is all smooth muscle. That one's not involved with any voluntary thing. So you can have a dysfunction of the intestinal muscle. You can have a tendency to accumulate stool and a problem with eliminating stool. We call this sometimes slow gastric motility. And you can make that much worse. Humans evolved eating roots and vegetables and the occasional bit of meat. Now we eat meat and ground up seeds and the occasional bit of fiber or fruit. So by flipping the diet against our evolution, we've run into a situation. So there's three things that you really have to do, with two of them behaviors and two of them intakes. One of them is adequate hydration. And I think that the daughter may be running into problems there, because fiber supplements without increased fluid will not work. In fact, they will make constipation worse, because you will be stuffing cement into the pipe, and what you want is goo. And the only way that you turn that fiber into goo, which is lubricating, is to mix it with lots and lots of water. So taking supplement capsules and not probably, I would say, drinking 16 to 24 volume water with the supplement capsules is one of the ways you can get yourself into worse trouble. Miralax is a compound that draws water into the gut, so it's essentially an osmotic laxative. It won't work if there's not enough water to go around, because the gut will want to keep the water in the bloodstream. So increased hydration and exercise, because exercise tends to stimulate muscle contraction, and it's very effective. If you exercise regularly, that really helps if you're having problems with regularity. And then, and only then, after hydration and exercise, do we come to fiber. I spoke about psyllium seed a few weeks ago, and I was doing it in my coffee, I found a much better solution, which is a very dilute fruit juice, and just mix it in and chug it down. And fruit juice for me is about 1/5 fruit juice and 4/5 water. It's enough to give it a taste, so that it isn't too weird to be drinking something thick and tasteless, which is just odd. The most important thing is staying off the toilet. Now, I know that sounds sounds contradictory. You're constipated. You want to go to the toilet when you have to poop. And if you try to poop and you can't, you want to get up and walk around or drink some more fluid or eat something to try to trigger the gastrocolic reflex. Because if you stretch the stomach fibers, you contract the rectal fibers. It makes sense. If you've ever had a baby, you know if you're going on a long car ride and you want them to poop, you give them a feeding and then let them poop and then put a fresh diaper on and then get in the car. And that is a reflex. Infants have no control over their sphincter. What controls their sphincter is whether their stomach is empty or full. Pregnancy, well, then you're carrying around, well, let's see. First it's an egg, then it's a lemon, then it's a cantaloupe, then it's a watermelon, and it's pushing. It's pushing hard on the big veins in the pelvis. And so it's causing back pressure. And when you have back pressure, the fluid goes sideways and it can go into these rectal veins and they'll blow out on you if they're weak. Plus, getting older, this is a good reason to use a standing desk. So if daughter is doing a lot of screen time and she's doing it sitting, just moving to a standing or a treadmill desk could help a lot. And that ends the answer to Brad's email. So we're going to segue to our first news story. We're going to talk about, we've talked so much about the microbiome, but it's kind of gross to collect poop. Well, what if we could just smell your breath and get clues about your microbiome? Well, now, proof of concept established in this article published in Cell Metabolism, looking at the volatilome, which is for volatile organic compounds. Remember, I said that was our first course. So they hypothesized that breath contains microbe, gut microbe-derived volatile organic compounds that are specific and reflect microbiota composition and metabolism. They also established later on in the study, we'll talk in some detail about it, that they could use the breath of children to determine their risk for asthma, which is extremely intriguing and opens up a great Pandora's box of what can we do with measuring breath. Now, that breathing into a balloon and then sending that to a lab sounds a lot easier than getting your blood drawn or collecting a poop sample. Well, basically, most of the studies have focused on these volatile organic compounds. Most of these are circular rings of molecules, and kind of like a benzene ring. And some of them are very low molecular weight molecules that basically turn into a gas at body temperature and at atmospheric pressure. Now, a lot of times we have a lot of volatile organic compounds in our environment, let's say when there's a fire, a house fire, and then, you know, your vinyl flooring and your pergo and everything is getting heated, and that's releasing them as gas. But there are, in fact, disease-associated volatile organic compounds that have been recently identified. So some of these are derived from the metabolism of microbes that colonize either the human gut or the human lung. And some of them have emerged now for the diagnosis of tuberculosis. There's a chemical that is specifically made by the Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And so you can identify tuberculosis in people who have active disease, at least, by getting a breath sample. And there's another one with this crazy name that I am not going to even try to say, but it's a category called a terpene, and it is high in subjects with malaria. Now, many of the volatile organic compounds produced in the gut are subject to what's called first-pass metabolism either in the skin or lining, I should say, of the gut or in the liver. And so these compounds are converted. They're produced by bacteria, but then they're converted by enzymes in the liver. And in fact, our second segment this night is going to go into even more detail about these enzymes and their normal functioning. But we're going to stay with the microbiome for the moment. So part of the research they did was they took mice that had sterile guts, and then they colonized their guts with specific bacteria, and then they looked at the differences in the mouths, in the breath space, if you will, of the mice, and they used a ingenious little mouse ventilator that somebody has invented to collect pure mouse lung breath. And they found that they could look at the fingerprint of the gas chromatography of the exhaled breath, and they could say, ah, that's got that bacteria or that combination of bacterias. So having established this, they then went after predicting the abundance of a disease-associated taxa. That's an extended family of a particular type of bacteria in pediatric patients with asthma. And so they were looking for whether or not asthma severity could be correlated with an increased intestinal abundance of a particular bacteria. And indeed, that's exactly what they found. This does not tell us cause or effect, but if you ask me, it says that it's much more likely that the asthma itself is being, the tendency towards it is being emphasized or supported by certain bacteria, because I think that the bacteria causing the disease in this case, or aggravating the tendency towards disease, makes a lot more sense than having asthma somehow changing the microbiome. I'm having trouble with the inverse of that particular correlation does not equal causation. So just plain old common sense seems to put the emphasis on there being a causal element of this. So again, we talk about genetics and environment. In this case, the asthma is, a tendency towards asthma and allergies is definitely an inherited thing. But what's going on in the inner environment, in the gut, is affecting the manifestation of the vulnerability into an actual disease process. And we know that a lot of what the bacteria put out actually gets changed in the liver. And so compounds produced in the gut will undergo biotransformation, and the skin cells lining the gut can actually contain the enzymes that will start transforming it. And then most of the blood leaves the gut and goes through the liver, where more transformation occurs. And then it gets to the lung after it's passed through the gut and through the liver, and then it gets sucked back up the inferior vena cava and dropped into the lung. And that's where it gets essentially pulled into the exhaled air and can be tested. And they've found that they see changes in the impact of these microbiota changes. So they've discovered risk factors for insulin resistance that might turn out to be useful clinically, although that's very early. Another thing that just is a cool factoid is that just like some microbiota eat oil or eat plastic, and we're trying to figure out how to weaponize them to help us climb out of our environmental soup, they've discovered that that certain bacteria, this one's called aerofacins, in mice, again, these mice had a sterile gut and then were infected with just one bacteria, and they found that these mice were getting rid of styrene in their breath at one level because they were eating some plastic, and then when they infused them with this particular bacteria, it was clearly breaking down the styrene, and so the level of the environmental toxins they were getting processed before they got into the lungs, which argues that there may be some lung detoxification and gut detoxification that could be weaponized. So let's take a moment and remind you, we're heading into detox, and it means something different depending upon where you stand. But it's been kind of overused in alternative medicine as a sort of, virtue signaling a little bit, and also just kind of, I'm doing my January detox because I care about my body. And really, we're all detoxing all the time because we're all putting out in the process of our own physiology things that need to be broken down and removed from the body. And then, of course, yes, we do have an environmental issue. We've got more, besides all that carbon dioxide, we've got a whole bunch more of things that we shouldn't really want to breathe, broken down bits of compounds that never existed on the surface of the planet until we invented them. These foreign compounds, they get into our bodies through the food, the air, some of them penetrate our skins. And in order to get rid of them, we really need to have a healthy diet. And by a healthy diet, I'm talking about a wide variety of fruits and vegetables, because the secret sauce of detoxification are the compounds, the bioflavonoids, that are included in the fruits and vegetables. Ironically, they're in the fruits and vegetables to keep the fruits and vegetables from being eaten by insects. They're basically toxins, but they're kinder, gentler toxins. And when you eat them, our liver develops better muscles effectively. It develops better enzyme systems to break down these toxins. It gets a lot of practice at breaking down these chemical bonds. So then when a new-to-nature molecule kind of floats by, the liver says, aha, I've got you, and grabs it by the throat and detoxifies it. And we'll talk about how that works. But smoking, food additives, pesticides, drugs, alcohol, and like I said, you're in normal metabolism, and oh yes, let's not forget the microbiome. The microbiome can build up in and of itself a lot of toxins because when bacteria die, they break up, and some of the compounds that are left over are very, very irritating to our immune system, very pro-inflammatory. So those are all the reasons that you want to think about getting supporting your detox. Here's some other reasons. These are the things that people come to functional medicine doctors with, among others, because they've been to the neurologist and they've been to the rheumatologist and they've been to the orthopedist and they've been to the psychiatrist and they're still sick because they don't have one of those things, but they're suffering. They have migraines. They have fibromyalgia. They have generalized joint pain. They have chemical sensitivity, where they get a headache when they go into a tire store, or they're just tired all the time. So detoxification and a program to support it is very important to reduce your risk of getting these things. There's other things that you can do besides eating lots of organically grown vegetables, fruit, and grains. If you can't eat organic, then eat non-organic, but look at the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15. You can go to, you just search that in a search engine, you'll get your list. The Dirty Dozen are the things where you really want to try to eat organic. If that means buying frozen, because that you can afford, then buy frozen. But the Clean 15, you don't have to buy organic because they don't carry a bunch of pesticides and other chemicals along for the ride just by the virtue of the way they're grown. and drink plenty of water. We were talking about hydration earlier. Hydration is key because it moves stuff through, and you have to poop at least once a day. Twice a day is better if you can manage it. That generally, the indication is, you know, pooping once in the morning and then pooping again maybe after dinner or after lunch, and that's not everybody can achieve that. But once a day is kind of the low bar, and you work until you get that. That's super important. I see we have a call coming in. We're going to take that call right now. Hello, you are on the air with Dr. Don. What's your name and where are you calling from?
John from Santa Cruz.
Hey, John from Santa Cruz. What's your question or comment?
Well, you had just mentioned hydration.
Yes.
And I have a question for you relative to Penta water is a little bit more on the acidic side, whereas we're coming up with all these waters that are basic in nature, sometimes all the way up to 10-0. What's your feeling on the basic versus acidic water for detox or just in general?
Well, all right. So you having an alkaline urine is the goal here. You can't alkalinize your blood, you know, not really, because your kidney wants your blood to be in a certain range. It's like if you try to alkalinize your blood, your kidney's going to add acid. So you're going to spin your wheels there. But if you eat an excess of things that are alkaline, which is to say fruits and vegetables relative to animal products, which are high in amino acids, which are, guess what, acids, if it should be, ideally it's a 3-to-1 ratio of the vegetables, fruits, and grains to meats and eggs and other things that contain amino acids. And so hydration that is already a little alkaline is helpful, but it has to essentially, so you're going to be adding more base to the mix. You can get really fancy and pay a lot of money for it, but you can also go get literally a small box of Arm & Hammer baking soda and add just a little pinch of baking soda to your regular water and check the pH with pH paper, and you'll see that you can drive up the pH to a pH of 8 without spending any money at all. And that's going to do you just as much good as these other fancy waters. So I'd rather you ate the fruits and vegetables, because they, along for the ride with them, comes all this good stuff that supports your detoxification.
I love fruits and vegetables.
Good.
They're just so good.
So if you want more alkaline water, get out the bicarb. Baking soda. It's perfect.
Okay. I went for a little bit different way. I took one bottle of everything they had at the store in the bottles, and I tasted them, and I found a couple that tasted pretty good. The other ones, not so much.
Okay, so you went for the sommelier strategy.
Yeah.
It's little water with just a touch of effervescence, right?
Yeah, and then I've got my lemon tree out back, so I'm good to go.
Yeah, and you know, that's kind of weird, isn't it? Because lemons are acidic, but they actually alkalinize. And the reason for that is that those good old kidneys, man, you put that acid in, the kidney says, no, I'm going to put some base in. And it puts a little more base than it needs to get the pH exactly back to 7 or 7.2. You know, it's just, it's like, oh, we want to, let's just give ourselves a little buffer there in case they keep doing that. So super interesting. Sometimes things are very paradoxical, and I love that eating lemons increases your alkaline in your urine. And do check your urine. Get some pH paper and monitor your urine, because sometimes you may find that you're not able to alkalinize it, and you need to take a look at what you're eating and see what's sneaking in.
Okay. I have one final question.
Sure.
Manuka honey. Do you know about it, and what do you think about it?
Well, honey in general is very well-renowned for being a wonderful wound dressing. And so Manuka honey has particular compounds in it that are very antibacterial, actually antiviral as well. So it's a great thing to put on a burn or a blister, and, you know, natural and not an antibiotic. The
the idea that you're gaining some great benefit by, you know, using that instead of regular organic honey, I haven't really seen much data supporting it. Lots of flowery declarative statements, but not a lot of data.
Okay, well, thank you for your help. I appreciate that.
Hey, I'm happy for the call. Have a wonderful evening.
You also. Bye-bye.
Bye. So we were just kind of talking about how to minimize toxins in your diet, and don't forget your air. So use an air purification system, and particularly in your bathroom, in your bedroom, excuse me, and change the filters. For goodness sakes, if you have a furnace or air conditioners, change the filters according to the manufacturer's suggestions. Yes, they probably enjoy making the money when you buy the filters, but on the other hand, you have these things in order to breathe cleaner air, and the indoor air pollution problem that we see is a big part of toxins in the environment. Wear protective clothing and masks and appropriate breathers if necessary when working with toxic materials. If it says use in a well-ventilated area, that basically for most of us means outside. And just because you can't smell it doesn't mean it's not a problem. Many of these VOCs do not have an odor that's apparent, but they do require detoxification. Another thing I wanted to address is detoxification requires a lot of energy. And so fasting, just a water fast or a juice fast, is going to deplete your body. It's definitely going to cause your body to go out and scavenge garbage. So it will do that. But it's also depleting you of the ability to get rid of that garbage. And in fact, you may half process the garbage. I'll come back to that in a minute. But that's the most dangerous thing of all. If you're over 50, I don't recommend fasting for more than 24 hours. You will start to eat your own body protein. And it's very hard to rebuild muscle. So I just, this is something you do when you're in an extreme situation, like on a raft in a lifeboat and in the middle of the ocean, or snowed in on a trail somewhere. But this is not something you should do to get healthier. And it's because your body can't process the stuff if it doesn't have the tools it needs. Oh, there are a number of things that you can eat that help support detox. I'll wrap up with that one. But I want to rewind just to what the heck is going on. So there's two kinds of toxins, really. There's the stuff that we don't care about because it's easily dissolved in water and our kidneys get rid of it right away. And then there are the fatty molecules that don't blend well with water, so that they don't come out into the filtering mechanism of the urine, or of the kidney into urine. So you need to actually change these fatty molecules from fat-soluble substances into water-soluble molecules that you can get out of the body. The fat-soluble stuff, you can't put them anywhere. They just soak through the walls and go back into the circulation. So fat-soluble toxins are transformed either in the gut, a little bit happens on the skin, on the surface of the skin. Most of it's happening in the liver. We had just taken those fat-soluble molecules and turned them into a reactive intermediate, and we made them reactive so we could hook them up with a water-soluble molecule. But while they're sitting there in the liver as a reactive intermediate, we want a short dwell time for those guys because they can stick to DNA. And they can damage the surfaces of the blood vessels or the linings of the blood vessels. So they're like hot sparks, but we want to quench them, and we quench them with phase two detoxification. So what helps with that? Well, we take molecules like glutathione, sulfur molecules, and there's about four or five others, and we simply attach them. And this makes a chemical bond. And now these things are water soluble. So they are going to sit in the gut, and they're not going to be able to diffuse to escape across the gut wall. Or they'll sit in the bladder and they're stuck there. They can't get out until you empty them yourself. Among other things that help improve this process are green tea, crucifers, garlic, and curcumin. So these are, if you drink green tea and you eat your broccoli or your watercress or whatever you like that's in the crucifers and have some garlic or some leeks a couple of times a week, you'll be feeding that phase two detox, making sure that there is a big enough woodpile of materials to attach to those reactive intermediates that they are neutralized and removed through the bile and poop or through the urine. And there are a few minerals you might want to add into the mix. Zinc, beneficial probiotics, pretty much most of the B vitamins, plus A, C, E, beta carotene. Yeah, pretty much a multivitamin will do it. Certain amino acids, L-cysteine, L-glutamine, and taurine all help with detoxification. A lot of times people take a protein supplement or an amino acid that has all those amino acids in it. And some supplements are actually, they call themselves detox supplements. So they're not muscle building supplements. They're more biased towards the detoxification. And I'll tell my patients to use those if we're trying to get their mercury levels or their lead levels down. And protein, but green tea, man, green tea or green tea extract and lots of water are probably the two most important things. That and the multivitamin and lots of fruits and veggies, and you will be detoxing your way to a healthier tomorrow. We have another call coming in. Hello, you're on the air talking to Dr. Don. Give me your name and where you're calling from, please.
Santa Cruz.
Oh, hello, Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you. I recently had like a cardiac problem there, and I had one 8 years ago. I had to have two stents to put my ticker there, and then like this... this last November, I had like another stent put in because the only thing is I waited about 3 days. So I thought it was an indigestion there, but said I was having another heart attack, and I thought, oh boy. So I called in, and I went to the hospital for about 3 days, and that's when they put the third stent in. And I just wondered, I'm going to take a lifestyle management course to the Dominican Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of contemplating the two diets. I'm contemplating like there's a DASH diet and the Mediterranean diet there, and I was wondering, what in the world is the difference between the two?
Well, the DASH diet is designed, basically, to be a healthy diet that reduces hypertension. So that was their goal, was they looked at research and said, oh, this calcium brings down hypertension. We'll make sure people get 800 milligrams of calcium. And so they include a lot of dairy and calcium in the DASH diet, because their goal was hypertension. So the biggest difference between the two is that the dairy is, a bigger piece. The Mediterranean diet, while it does have some cheese in it, it's much more grains and fish, and these contain, and whole grains, which are contain, among other things, a lot of fiber. We've been talking about fiber quite a lot here. And fiber does bind cholesterol in the intestine to a certain extent, so you poop out some of your cholesterol when you eat a high-fiber diet. So that can be a good thing. So if you've had effectively three blocked blood vessels at this point, you have the disease, the blood vessel-blocking disease. And so you have to reduce the stuff that blocks the blood vessels. And you want to have as little of that floating around in your system as possible. Typically, after three stents, they've got you on a statin, maybe on a statin and also a cholesterol absorber.
I had thing about five or six different medications when I got to the hospital. And I'm just thankful one of the pharmacists delivered medications to my hospital room. Otherwise, I couldn't have gone because I had to go straight home. And you can see my point there.
Yes. Well, used to actually, and this is one of the sad things about, there's a lot of sad things about the deterioration of the sanity of our medical system. But the big one is sending people home without the medications they need for the first 24 hours after their hospitalization is just dumb. It's just colossally dumb because, you know, a lot of times I'll write a drug and then I get, well, I'm sorry, the insurance doesn't cover that. You'll have to do a prior authorization or make a substitution. Meanwhile, my patient is sitting at home without his meds. I can't tell you how frustrating I find that, but you probably hear it in my voice. Anyway, getting back to your question, Mediterranean diet more than DASH diet. And then was there a follow-up question? You are on statins. That's good. You've got to keep that. You want to keep your inflammation low, so they should be checking the hsCRP. You should be taking fish oil. Fish oil helps with inflammation, and particularly it's very important. And eating that diet that we've been talking about for detox, the one with lots of 2/3 or 3/4 fruits and vegetables and grains and 1/4 meat, and making sure that meat is like fish and chicken more than beef. Those are legitimate dietary strategies that can be very helpful harnessing this disease and keeping it in check.
Yeah, I definitely don't want it to get any worse there, because I don't want to end up for a bypass or anything like that. And I just want to stay out of hospitals. I don't mind, you know, visiting them or visiting a person or working them, but to be a person one, no, thank you. I just rather keep the bed for someone else that really needs it.
Well, you have a new hobby. Which is
I got to start working on exercising too. I'm really terrible at that, and it's kind of.
What did you like to do? What did you like to do as a kid?
Oh.
Did you like to bicycle? Did you like to skateboard? What did you like to do as a kid?
I don't know. I kind of can't remember that, but I kind of had like a depressing childhood.
All right.
You know, my mom had problems and she dealt them with alcohol, and I'll just leave it like that, you know?
Well, I'll tell you what, then. Try everything. You know, just there's something called meetup.com, and these are groups of people who, they go out in the water, they swim, they hike. They're just a random group of people who would prefer to get their exercise and have a conversation and hang out and get their exercise. And there's lots of them in Santa Cruz. There are tons of classes. No matter what your age, if you're a senior, there's lots of senior classes. They're graded. You're going to go through this lifestyle thing, but while you're going over there, get them to help you look at resources. Most of these classes, you can show up once for free and just try it out. And they have a gym over on East Cliff where the Lifestyle Center is. They've got a nice rehab gym. And if you like the weight room, you know, when you do that, if you like that, they've got a sliding scale and it's never crowded. You can get in there and use the machines and you will qualify because you have a medical diagnosis.
Yeah, plus I'm on Medicare. There's some kind of, I'll be like a 69 this March year, so I'll be really old and hoping another year better, you know.
Well, let me just tell you that your chronological years mean a lot less now than they meant in your teens. You know, you need to treat yourself like a classic car. You know, change the oil, keep the tires at the right inflation. And like I said, it's a hobby of keeping up the vehicle that you live on and in. And there's all sorts of things that will be very helpful. And the people at the Lifestyle Center are there to inspire you make changes that will have a long-term benefit. It's kind of like putting money if you put, back in the day when savings accounts paid interest, you know, I know, but let's think of a certificate of deposit. It's basically the same thing. You put that money away and it builds, right? And then 5 years later, your age, if you really behaved yourself, you could actually reduce your physiologic age from where it is now, because we have all these things we can test. You could reduce your physiologic age by 3 to 5 years if you, like, did everything right. and you can freeze your biological age.
Or with help with like sleep apnea?
Depends on, you know, there's all sorts. We can spend forever talking about sleep apnea because it's complicated, but getting down to a healthy body weight makes a huge difference.
That's a goal,
if you aren't there, that's a goal. And getting regular exercise, that's very good for your heart. And if you do have a fever or a pneumonia or some, or you get hit by, you know, get hit by a kid on an e-bike, that's getting more and more likely. And you end up, you know, with a stressor to your system, all of that cardiovascular work that you've done is going to make it much more likely that that doesn't tip you into another heart attack too. You'll have more resistance to what the universe throws at you.
Oh yeah, because I'm definitely hypersensitive, and I've been diagnosed with ADHD there, so I think that kind of adds more to the subject of stress.
But people with ADHD come through the other side, and they build resilience. And it takes a lot of work to get through it, but they come out stronger than they were. And that's the main thing.
That's what I'm going to try to go for there.
All right. Well, good luck. And like I said, that rehab center, that lifestyle center, they're an enormous resource. And a lot of people just blow through there, show up for the things, and they don't ask, and they don't look around for what else is available. But if you're interested and you ask, it's a treasure chest.
Oh, so it's called Meetup. That sounds very interesting. I have to probably talk to someone that has a computer. I don't have a computer nor a smartphone, so.
No, you just no excuses. You just go to the library. You go to the library. The librarian will help you set up an email account. And then you can just write down the password and go back into the library every couple of days and check your email account. And you can sign up for the Meetup with the email account. And it doesn't cost anything. And it's like I said, it's like a treasure chest.
Right on.
All right. Well, I'm going to let you go. Thanks for the call.
Well, thank you much for your time, Dr. Don, and have yourself a wonderful day, okay?
You as well. Have a wonderful day tomorrow. Bye-bye. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDon.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Don is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.